From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. I'm sure it was number 31 by A. M. Barrage. Alfred McLeland Barrage had his greatest success in 1930 with his novel War is War under the pseudonym X Private X, but he is now remembered mainly as one of the finest English ghost story writers alongside Benson, Wakefield, and James. His half-century career as a prolific writer for the popular magazines began at the age of 17. It happened many years ago when I was a boy of 18, out house hunting for my mother in a London suburb within a mile and a half of where we were then living. There were many houses to be let in those happy Edwardian days, and having a bicycle and knowing my mother's requirements, I could thus save her fruitless journeys to some which I knew she would not consider. I had in my pocket several orders to view from local agents. It was on my way to an address when the strangest incident of my life befell me. It was on a sunny October afternoon, and apart from feeling lethargic and depressed, I believe I was in a normal state of health. My way took me along a tram route, and all the side roads on my left were cul-de-sacs, ending at the boundary wall of a great park. I looked down all these side roads as I passed, and suddenly I stopped at a corner and got off my machine, for I had seen a to-let board slanting over some railings about halfway down on the right. It was a road of small villas, just suitable for our purpose, and the board belonged to agents with whom we were already in touch. Then, although I could find no house in that road on my list, I decided to go and investigate. So I rode up, balanced my machine against the curb, and rang the bell. I was quite unprepared for the sight of the lady who came to the door. She seemed old to my young eyes, although I dare say she was under 40, and I forget how she was dressed, but instinct told me at a glance that she was out of her proper setting in that shabby little house. I quickly explained my errand and apologized for having no order to view. At the same time, I offered to show her other orders from the same agent. "Oh," she said, "I'm sorry. The man ought to have taken the board away. I've decided to stay on." I think she recognized me, as already I had recognized her, as someone who had seen better days. I was a shabby, untidy, lank-haired sallow boy, not at all of the type to interest a heart-hungry widow. Probably I looked very tired and jaded. Whatever the reason, she said, "Won't you come in and have a cup of tea?" She was just like some other fellows made her in the days before poverty had changed my environment, and all my shyness went from me on the instant. I followed her into the front room, where two surprises awaited me. The lesser of these was the furniture, much too massive for its setting, and the oil paintings of Army and Navy officers of past generations. The greater surprise was the girl of about 16, who rose to greet me as her mother said, "This is my daughter, Mumps, darling. I don't yet know this gentleman's name. I dare say I was still staring as I supplied it. She was about the most vivid and striking young person I had ever seen, with long black hair hanging loose over her shoulders and a wonderful warm complexion which seemed to light the room for me. Chocolate box prettiness? Well, perhaps it was, but it reduced me for a time to bashful nervousness. We sat talking for a while, and my hostess succeeded in overcoming my shyness by talking about herself. Her name was Ellis, and I gathered that she was a widow. Invariably, she addressed her daughter as Mumps, and I never knew the girl's real Christian name. Presently, I noticed on one of the walls an oil painting of Mumps, done, apparently, a year or two before. It looked a little amateurish besides the others, and I was not surprised to hear that it was Mrs. Ellis's own work. "Oh, Mumps is a much better artist than I am," she laughed. "Show him some of your drawings, dear, while I get the tea." Mumps had little to say for herself, and seemed as shy as her new acquaintance. But she unearthed the portfolio and increased my embarrassment by showing some figure drawings, which struck me as being extremely well done, but rather startling. However, she displayed them in the same manner in which she might have shown me views of a cathedral. Had I been older and more experienced, I might have jumped to a certain conclusion about that mother and daughter, and I am sure that I should have been wrong. Whatever the mother may have done, and I suspect nothing worse than unpaid bills, there was nothing coarse about her. Besides, a shabby boy with only coppers in his pocket was hardly fair game for harpies. Over tea, I told him about myself. I wondered if they really believed that I had been, and probably still was, the youngest professional writer in the country, and that I had a story accepted a year before I left school. But even if Mrs. Ellis took me for a young liar, I was well aware that she liked me. She had told me little about herself, save that she was a widow, but mentioned one of her relatives when I told her about my father's terrible illness, which had left me a schoolboy of 17 with a penniless mother to support. "What a pity," she said, "that he didn't see my uncle," and she seemed a knighted physician in Harley Street. Well, I could not stay forever, and the time came for me to go. Mumps and her mother preceded me into the little hall, and I took leave first of the girl. Mrs. Ellis opened a door, and I said goodbye to her on the steps. Of course, I had been hoping that she would ask me to come again, but she did not. Her manner, despite her self-possession, was in the circumstances extraordinary. She seemed almost tearful, and might have been parting forever from an old and dear friend, for I knew that she liked me, just as I knew that she knew I had fallen in love with Mumps. Had I done the incredible and bending over and kissing her, I know she would have given me a little hug, and a moment later she would have closed the door softly upon me forever. Why? I do not know. It all seemed very strange, but I was yet to realize how extraordinary had been the events of that afternoon. Of course, I remembered Mrs. Ellis's address. The road was marked by a corner shop. I bought cigarettes there on my way home, and the number 31 was easily memorized as the reverse of the unlucky 13. During the following day, and indeed for many days, I could not get the girl out of my head. She balked my efforts to write cheap fiction. I felt I must see her again or go mad. It did not seem so difficult, for a short cycle ride brought me to the corner of her road. Even if she still went to school, and my impression was that she did not, there was always the chance of meeting her mother out shopping and getting a casual invitation to tea. For hours at a time, mornings and afternoon, I haunted the main street of that other suburb during the next fortnight, and haunted it in vain. Passing and repassing the top of the road, I could catch no glimpse of either lady, but saw, as I had expected, that the estate agent's board was gone. At the end of the fortnight, I decided in desperation to make an uninvited call, timing myself to arrive at tea time, my excuse? Oh, I could tell Mrs. Ellis that we had not yet found a suitable house, and ask if she had heard of one. She would see through me, of course, but I could not help it. I knew I ought to keep away, but I went, to desolation and bewilderment. I thought at first that it was a charwoman who came to the door, although I could see that the furniture in the hall had changed, and not for the better since my other visit. "Mrs. Ellis," said the woman, shaking her head. "No, I don't know the name around here, and we've been here nearly 2 years." I apologized and bolted. After all, I must have made a mistake in the number. But I was sure of the road, because it was marked by the corner shop, and the man there would know. I went in and bought a packet of cigarettes, and it was the same man who served me again. He gave me a strange look. "Mrs. Ellis? Well, she used to live at number 31, but she's been gone about 2 years now." Then, probably mistaking the look on my face, he added, "A lot of people would like to know what became of her." The innuendo was obvious. A moonlit flit and money owed all around. Yes, but at tea with her in that house a fortnight before. There was a stupid mistake somewhere. But the man described her and Mumps, even mentioning the silly nickname. Further, he knew about the Harley Street doctor. "Yes," he said, "she was well connected, that lady. I wonder where she went. It's a long time now. Your governor's going to have a job to find her." I was too shocked and dazed to resent being taken for a debt collector spy. All I realized was that a fortnight before, I had had tea with two ladies in the house, from which they had vanished 2 years earlier, while at the same time it was occupied by others. Further, that I had been strongly attracted to a girl who might be a ghost or a dream. Of course she could be neither, but on the other hand, what had become of her and her mother? I could not possibly have dreamed of real people of whom I had never heard. And never since have I heard of them, nor met any who knew them. I could, of course, have written to the Harley Street doctor, but such a letter would be difficult enough for me even today. It was beyond the troubled lad of 18, who was afraid of being taken for a liar, or of plunging into troubled waters, where he had no business. So I never solved the mystery, and now, but for some very strange chance indeed, I know that I never shall.